My guest at this time is Grace Marie Turner, president and founder of the Galen Institute, one of the leading healthcare policy organizations in the country. The Galen Institute has joined with a number of other organizations in filing a brief for the Supreme Court in advance of next month's hearings on the constitutionality of the individual mandate as imposed by the president's health care plan. It's obviously gone through a number of levels of the judicial system, and the Supreme Court will hear all about it in extended hearings next month, and a final decision on the mandate and some other issues is expected by June. And Grace Marie, thanks so much for being with us.
Greg, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, you've joined here with the Pacific Research Institute, the Benjamin Rush Society, Docs for Patient Care, and others, and let's just talk about what the key to this brief is, and that is that one of the president's explanations for needing the individual mandate, and that's that too many people who don't have coverage come into the hospital, and then those who do have coverage end up getting soaked with that because those other people don't have coverage. You have discovered that the plan that the president has signed into law doesn't do that, and you claim it actually makes it worse. Explain why.
Well, you know, that was really one of the key reasons that they argued for passage of this monstrous law. The people are showing up in hospital emergency rooms, they're demanding care, and they're not paying for it. And so we decided that let's take a look at that and see if that justification really holds true. And when you break down the numbers, as we did in detail, and people can find the full brief on our website at galen.org, when you look at this in detail, you see that not only does the individual mandate not solve this problem, but it actually makes it worse because it shifts costs in a different way, but adds more people to the cost-shifting dynamic. And so when you talk with the Supreme Court, and you have to talk about specific legal arguments. I mean, we all know this law is a monstrous violation of the Constitution in so many ways, but the court really takes these arguments apart in a very specific way, and it says, tell us whether or not the facts which the Congress laid out in the law are actually true, and is it solving the problem that the legislation was designed to solve? So in a very micro way, we say it absolutely does not, and here is the long, both mathematical as well as legal explanation of why we say it does not solve that problem. So if your justification for the individual mandate is that you're going to solve a problem and it doesn't solve that problem, then we're arguing, therefore, you should strike it because it's not only bad law, but it also doesn't achieve the legal goal that they said they were trying to achieve.
We're talking with Grace Marie Turner of the Galen Institute. And Grace Marie, there may be some people, either supporters of the bill or just knowledgeable about it, who say, well, if everyone has coverage, that means everyone has insurance. And if they need medical care, then that policy pays those bills minus any deductibles or so forth. So how did the cost get shifted around and actually make it worse?
Well, you know, it's really just a big shell game because right now the government assumes that I think it was Families USA study they cited, assume that we spend about $43 billion a year in so-called uncompensated care. That's what the uninsured consume, and they don't pay their bills. So that really, when you take that apart and really look at where is the money coming from? Well, some of that $43 billion is paid for through existing programs like hospital payments to hospitals, federal payments to hospitals for uncompensated care, so-called DSH payments. So that's part of it. There are lots of other ways in which hospitals and even physicians are compensated for this so-called uncompensated care. So it really, the numbers just really, I mean, it's a very complex system of arguments and breaking these numbers down in many different ways to show that, in fact, this is not only not solving the problem, it's making it worse because you're adding, for example, so many more people to Medicaid, which pays doctors and hospitals at about 60% of their costs, And so you're just shifting the cost in a different way. And we've already seen how this happens in Massachusetts. One of the reasons that Governor Romney used to argue for passage of RomneyCare was this so-called free rider problem. Well, what you see now is that there are more people showing up in a hospital emergency room seeking care, and there are as many, if not more, of them seeking care who are uninsured. Remember, Obamacare does not lead to universal coverage. 23 million people, even according to the best estimates, still will be uninsured, still will show up in hospital emergency rooms demanding care that they may or may not be able to pay for. So all of these cost-shifting problems continue to exist and will not be solved by the law. So here you have this monstrous piece of legislation that would truly dramatically change the relationship between citizens and government, that's trying to solve a big problem of $43 billion out of, by the way, $2.6 trillion in annual spending on healthcare, less than 1% of spending. And you're saying that you're going to solve this problem by this unconstitutional mandate? I mean, it just shows this whole thinking behind this law, the whole concept of it, is just fundamentally flawed down to its very DNA.
Grace Marie, just to back up a little bit here, I know that the law is already on the books, but in terms of those who don't have insurance, and we should point out that I think it's safe to say that most people who don't think a mandate is a good idea still think having health insurance is usually a pretty good idea. But if I don't pay my mortgage, the house gets foreclosed on. If I don't pay for my car, my furniture, they get repossessed. If I don't pay my utility bills, they get shut off. Why do these people not pay their bills and suffer no legal consequences?
Well, because we're a humanitarian country, and we're not going to deny somebody medical care if they show up at a hospital and they're bleeding and they need care. But there are better ways to make sure that they have insurance. And that's what we're really talking about. We're talking about, does somebody have the resources to pay for these bills? And if not, then you need insurance. That's why we have insurance for all sorts of other things, like car accidents and fires for our homes, etc. Things that would be difficult to pay out of our regular monthly, as part of a regular monthly bill. So you need insurance. But there are better ways to do that. If you were to reorganize the way that some of the funding takes place in our health sector so that people were to get a credit that goes to them exclusively for health insurance, and then if they don't buy the policy, and they can use that credit to buy a policy that they may choose, and if they don't, then they could get bought into a policy with their name on it that would cover those bills when they went to the hospital. So you do not have to have an unconstitutional individual mandate to make sure that everybody has health insurance. You just need to reorganize the financing so that, A, people have more choice and more portability of that coverage, but you also have an opportunity for them to make sure they've got at least a high deductible catastrophic policy if they wind up at a hospital needing care that they can't pay for. We do not need Obamacare and its 2,800 pages of legislation and tens of thousands of pages of regulation to solve that problem.
Grace Marie, last question real quick. The Supreme Court obviously is taking up this huge case. This case has been at the appellate level, the district level. How closely do they look at briefs such as the one that you and these other organizations are filing?
You know, as I'm not a lawyer, so this is all kind of new to me. Our brief is filed as, you know, people who understand the health sector. But it's interesting because who's on the brief is often who the signers and who the lawyers that wrote it are is often one of the things that they hope will get the attention of the justices and their clerks to actually read the brief. They will get hundreds of amicus briefs, friends of the court briefs, and you just want to make sure yours is read. Now, just like anything else, there's sort of a summary, and you hope they get through that, and then you hope they get through the more detailed arguments. But if you have a justice that has decided that the case hinges on one of these key legal arguments, you want to make sure that those legal arguments are there, that the work has been done with the other court citations, with the other case citations, and with the detailed breakdown of that argument, so that the work has been done for them if they decide that this is something that really resonates with them. And you just can't know with this court what those issues are going to be, but I think ours is really a key component, because this uncompensated care free rider issue was so important in the political case for passage of Obamacare, and yet when you take it apart, it completely collapses.
Very interesting. We'll see how much this comes up in the oral arguments and certainly in the decision when it ultimately comes down. Grace Marie, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Greg.
Grace Marie Turner is president of the Galen Institute, one of the leading healthcare policy organizations in the country. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, reporting for WorldNet Daily.